Whenever you come to study the book of Hebrews, and I know every week we have folks who haven't been here, and so it's always good to try to review or at least capsulize the book a little bit so that we're all together in our study. Here's a great book of the New Testament for us to dive into. There's so much for us to learn, not only about God's plan during the Old Testament, but God's plan once that Old Testament was taken out of the way, that he was to put a new covenant in its place. When we get over to chapter 10 and verse 9, we'll see that he took away the first, that he may establish the second. That's the great dividing line in the book of Hebrews, is the division between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. And the problem was that there were some who had become Christians, who were now living under that New Covenant, had been obedient to Christ, but they were turning away from Christ and going back to that old covenant, to that first covenant that God had made obsolete, that he had taken out of the way. He had nailed it to the cross. It was inferior compared to the superior nature of the new covenant. And yet they were turning their back on that, on their relationship with Christ and going back. And so the writer pleads with them to come back. He pleads with them to not fall away. The possibility of apostasy is throughout this book emphasized, that you can become a Christian and then live in such a way that you fall away from Christ. And so he's pleading with them, and we're going to pick up in chapter 3 and verse 12. This is in the middle of his second major exhortation. The first one was back in chapter 2, where he pleaded with them not to drift away from the word. Here in chapter 3, beginning of verse 7, he's pleading with them not to doubt the word. And what he does is he presents to them, starting in verse 7 of chapter 3, he presents to them the example of the Israelites as a horrible example of faithfulness or a good example of unfaithfulness. You figure out which direction you want to go. And he says, this is the pattern, the example we don't need to follow. And so he quotes from Psalm 95 in verses 7 through 11, where God had told them that they would not enter into that rest that he had promised to give unto them. But the application starts in verse 12, and we looked at verses 12, 13, and 14 last week, but we'll read through these as a way of reminder as we get into the study tonight. He says in verse 12, beware, look, open your eyes. You got to pay attention. Beware, brethren, lest, that's a word of warning, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief. Who could fall away? Anybody. He's warning them. He's telling them, lest this happen to you, you need to open your eyes. Even you could develop an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. He likes to emphasize the living God in this book. And it's interesting, the word living is not an adjective. The way that it's used in this book, the word living, we use the word living perhaps as an adjective. You know, that's a living animal. But he doesn't use it as an adjective. He uses it a verb. It's a present tense verb, meaning this is the God who lives. Not past tense, not just a characteristic that he has. He's living. This is a verb. This is a present tense verb. Don't depart from the living God. Verse 13, but exhort each other, everybody. How often? Daily, every day. Instead of allowing an evil heart of unbelief to develop within you, every day you need to exhort each other while it is called, quote, today. If you go back up to verse 7, you see that's the first word in his quotation from Psalm 95. He says, while it's called today, we need to be exhorting each other. And then you see this word again, lest, a word of warning, lest any of you. So twice in these two verses, you have the word lest, a word of warning. You have the word any twice in these verses, indicating that you need to pay attention. No one is exempt from the possibility of falling away, lest there be in any of you, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ. What's the word you have after that? You have the word if. We noticed this word when we came through the passage back up in verse 6. We are his house if we hold fast our confidence. We saw the word if in verse 7. Now he uses it again. What does that mean? That our salvation, our continued relationship, our continued salvation in the eyes of God is conditional. Meaning once saved, not always saved. You must continue to remain faithful. You must, he says in verse 14, we must continue to hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. Just because you begin a relationship with Christ does not mean you will automatically continue in it. You've got to give diligence to that. We're going to see that again when we get over to chapter 4, verse 11. Verse 15, while it is said, notice what he does. He goes back and quotes this verse all over again. While it is said, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. You ever heard a preacher get on a passage, get on a verse, and he said the verse, he quoted the verse multiple times in a sermon, and you thought, you know, you've already quoted that verse three times. I think we got the idea. Under inspiration, what's the Holy Spirit doing? Going back and saying, folks, open your eyes. This is a key point for us to learn. Today is the day you need to make changes. If is a conditional word. Do not harden your hearts is the exhortation. Now starting in verse 16, he starts to summarize this, and I want you to see how he summarizes what transpires. Do you remember the story? Do you remember the story in Numbers 13 where Moses selected 12 men to go spy out the promised land? Why did he select 12? One from each tribe. Go and spy out the land. Now, this is not the same time that spies went into the promised land and camped out on top of Rahab's house. That's a different time. That's over in the book of Joshua. So twice we have that occurring. Do you remember how many spies were sent in Joshua chapter 2 to go and spy out the land and were hiding on top of Rahab's house? Remember how many went that time? It wasn't 12. How many faithful spies came back the first time? He sent 12 the first time. How many came back with a faithful message? Two. So the next time you get ready to send spies into the land, how many do they send? You know, two worked pretty good last time. We had 10 too many. Let's just start with two. Let's go with two the second time. That's not the reason. That's just an interesting little thing that, okay, because it was God's design for 12 to go the first time. But you remember the story. They come back. They all are in unit. They're all united in their message that it's a great land. It's a magnificent land that the Lord is, and they use the word giving to us. It's a gift. But that gift is conditional. You have to go and take it. And so he said, it's a great land. It's flowing with milk and honey, but there's giants in the land. There's the descendants of Anak in the land. We're like grasshoppers in their sight. And they even said, we're not only like grasshoppers in their sight, we're like grasshoppers in our own sight. That's pretty pitiful. When God's on your side and you look at yourself like, oh, we're not much. Wrong? You got God on your side. Were there consequences for their unfaithfulness, their unfaithful report? Yeah. Did those 10 unfaithful spies suffer consequences? Yes. Were they the only ones? Why did the rest of the nation suffer the same consequences? Because they followed in that path. They had a choice to make, didn't they? Did they have a choice to make? We got 10 spies on this side, we got two on this side. Who are we going to listen to? They did what too many people do today. They went with the popular opinion. They went with what most people would say. And where did that lead them? 40 years in the wilderness to die. What does God say about following a multitude to do evil? That's back in the book of Numbers, by the way. What does God say about that? Don't do it. And so here is the background to this exhortation. Look at verse 16. For who, having heard, it's not that they did not know, who having heard rebelled? Who was it who rebelled against God? Indeed, look at all these rhetorical questions. Indeed, because it's obvious who rebelled. Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt led by Moses? Was Moses a great leader? Yeah. People still fall away under his leadership? Universally they did. Unfortunate. Next question down in verse 17. Now, with whom was God angry 40 years? How long did they go in the wilderness? 40 years. One year for every day that those 12 spies were in the land. And so what happens? Who was God angry with those 40 years? He answers the question. Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? Now, I want you to see something. Verse 16 says that they rebelled. You see the word rebelled in verse 16? How are they described in verse 16? They rebelled. How are they described in verse 17? They sinned. Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? Now look at verse 18. And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest? Now that concept there of rest is his tag. That's his key word that he's going to take right into chapter 4. He's going to talk about that rest in chapter 4 more in this passage than anywhere else in the New Testament, as heaven talked about as a rest. But look in verse 18. To whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did what? Those who disobeyed. Verse 16, what'd they do? They rebelled. Verse 17, what'd they do? They sinned. Verse 18, what'd they do? They disobeyed. Are all of those actions or lack thereof, are all of those intentional decisions, are all of those activities that they chose to engage in, practices they chose to engage in, disobeying God, rebelled, sinned, disobeyed? Now I want you to see with those three terms how he summarizes it in verse 19. How does God summarize rebelling, sinning, and disobeying? What's the first word you have in verse 19? So, he's drawing a conclusion from all of these rhetorical questions he just asked. So, based upon what we've just seen, and the answers are obvious, so we see, present tense, we can look at it right now, we see that they could not enter. That word enter, he's drawing from Psalm 95. In that quotation from Psalm 95, the word enter again is one of those key words that he's going to take into chapter 4. We see they could not enter in because of what?
Unbelief.
What's he saying? You know, it is believed by many people today that you can be saved by faith alone. Don't get involved in any of these works are not going to save you, they say. You can be saved by accepting Jesus and believing in your heart He's the Son of God. And if you have faith, if you believe, God saves you even before you do anything else, just as long as you believe. What they don't understand in their study of the Bible is that God uses the word belief, as he defines it, synonymously with obedience. God doesn't look at belief and having a mental assent, an idea of who Jesus is. He does not look at belief as one thing and obedience as something beyond the faith. God looks at them together. How do we know that? Well, we could look at John 3:36. We could look at a number of places. But right here, what does he do? What have these people done? Rebelled, sinned, and disobeyed. How is that? What's the summary of that in verse 19? It was unbelief. So if unbelief is characterized by rebellion, sinning, and disobedience, what would belief be characterized by? Would God characterize belief as obedience? That's the way God defines belief. That's the way he defines faith. It is a faith that is active and obedient. Isn't this the book that has Hebrews chapter 11 in it? We're studying the book of Hebrews. Does Hebrews have Hebrews chapter 11? Now, that could be a trick question. Is this the book that has Hebrews chapter 14 in it? No, it doesn't. It only has 13 chapters. So now, is this the book that has Hebrews chapter 11 in it? Yes. Is that a chapter that emphasizes salvation by faith only? Just the opposite. It is a chapter that emphasizes faith, but it emphasizes faith the way God defines faith, an obedient faith. And so now, look, as he summarizes that at the end of chapter 3, what's the first word you have in chapter 4? Therefore, key word in this book, almost 30 times he's going to use it. He's drawing a conclusion from what he had just talked about in the fact that that God had told them that they could not enter into his rest. This goes all the way back even to chapter 3 and verse 7 and the exhortation that he made to them. Therefore, now in chapter 3, again, the theme of the book is that Christ is superior, that Christianity is superior to anything that Judaism or the Old Covenant had to offer. In chapter 3, he emphasized that Christ is superior to Moses. Now we get to chapter 4, and the emphasis of these first 13 verses in chapter 4 is that Christ is superior, or Christ's rest is superior to Joshua's rest, to any other rest that was promised. And that's the contrast that's going to be drawn here. He's going to use the word rest, I think it's 9 times. He's going to use the word rest here in these first 11 verses. But he's going to use the word rest in about 3 different ways as we read through this. And we'll see how he's using the word rest differently. He's going to use rest, primarily he's going to use rest as the rest promised to Christians. Where is the rest that is promised to Christians? Ultimately, that's in heaven. There's a verse over in the book of Revelation, chapter 14, verse 13. It begins in a very strange way, you might think. Blessed are the dead. You think, wait a minute, what's so good about being dead? Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord. Why are they blessed? Because that verse says they may rest from their labors. Is that a blessing? Heaven is a place of rest. Now, as we go through here, in case I don't mention this again, does the fact that heaven is a place of rest mean we're going to go there and do nothing? Does that mean, I did all of my work for God on earth, now I get to go to heaven and just chill out? I get to rest and not do anything. He's going to make the point in this chapter, and I'll say it now in case I forget to say it when we get there. How many days, think about this, how many days did it take for God to create the earth? And how many days did God create the earth? Say 6 and not 7, please. 6 days. Exodus 20 and verse 11. In 6 days, God created everything. Okay, 6 days. What did God do on the 7th day? Rested. What does that mean? Does that mean that when it got to day 7, that God stopped working altogether? He said, that's it. I worked for 6 days. I'm exhausted. I created everything. I'm done working. I'm not going to do any more work. Is that what that meant? That God rested? He stopped working? No. Is God still working? God still active in our lives? Yes. So it did not indicate that he stopped all working, but it indicated that he entered into a place of rest that he had designated, that he has promised to us. So let's look in chapter 4. Did I mention the 3 ways he uses the word rest? He uses the rest for heaven. He uses the word rest to talk about the rest that had been promised to the Israelites in the promised land. The land of Canaan was a place of rest. And then one time he's going to use the word rest to talk about what God did on the 7th day of the creation week, where God rested or ceased working on that day. But let's look in chapter 4, verse 1. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest. Now, what's fun about this chapter, most of the time when he uses the word rest, he's talking about heaven. What's fun about this chapter is to try to think about this chapter through a Jewish mind. They were headed toward Canaan. They were headed toward that land that God had shown unto Abraham and that Abraham had lived in and went all through. They were going towards that land that Moses had seen before his death. Now, what did they sometimes call that land? It was the what land? The promised land. Here's a land that is promised. So what does he say in chapter 4, verse 1? What do we have? A promise. We have a promise, and what does that promise do? It remains. It wasn't just a promise that was made available to those under the Jewish system. We, that word we in chapter 4, verse 1, is talking about Christians. Since a promise remains, of entering his rest, but here's a rest that is promised to those who are Christians today. Heaven is our promised land. It's better than a land flowing with milk and honey. It's better than a land where you can find anything and everything that you need. It's a land where God dwells. It is a promise that continues to be given to us. But I want you to see that word entering. You see the word entering? Remember that from verse 18 of the previous chapter and from the quotation of Psalm 95? They would not enter his rest. This word entering is a key word in these first 13 verses. The word enter and the word rest are used repeatedly through this. And I want you to see and understand why that's significant. Promise remains of entering his rest. If you need to enter into something, does that mean that you are not yet in it? Most of the time, right? When you were outside of this building, had you entered yet? No. But then you took that step inside and you entered into the building. So there's a contrast between you can be outside of this rest or you can be inside of this rest. There is a promise that we can enter into that rest. And so since that promise remains, comma, you see these two words, let us. I believe it's the first time it's been in this book. He says, let us. If you remember from our introduction class, we talked about the fact that here's a book that has 13 chapters. The key word in this book is the word better, that Christ is better, Christianity is better than all things. How many times is that word? It's got 13 chapters. How many times is that word better found in this book? 13 times you find the word better. That's his key word. And then you've got this little exhortation, these two words, let us, where the author, he's not just saying, here's what you and you and you and you need to do. He's drawing himself into this exhortation. He's saying, let us. 13 chapters, 13 betters. How many times does the phrase let us occur? 13 times two, not 26. 13 times also. You find this phrase better, or this phrase, let us. And I don't think that's tied to the number 13 chapters. It just helps me to remember that this is a key little phrase. He says, let us fear. That's an interesting statement. Let us fear lest. Remember that, what we saw in chapter 3? We saw it twice in chapter 3. Let us fear lest. What's the word you have to the word lest? Any. We saw that twice, didn't we? The end of chapter 3. Do this, lest, a word of warning, any, twice over there. Here, you've got it again in chapter 4, verse 1. Picking back up on that point that anybody could fail to reach it, but notice how he says in verse 1, let us fear lest any of you seem to have what? Fallen short. Come short of it. What does that mean? You don't make it to heaven. Could you get close to making it to heaven and God will grade on the curve and take you in? Could you get close to getting to heaven and he just rounds up? You know what I'm saying? You know, you get that 0.555. Let's just round it up. You know, it's more than halfway there. God says there is a promise of entering into heaven. And he says we need to watch out lest we come short. And the word come short, the way that verb is used there for come short indicates an abiding reality. Meaning once you come short of going to heaven, you can't do anything after that. The decision's already been made. But why does he say let us fear? I thought we weren't supposed to fear. I thought perfect love cast out fear. I thought he said do not fear. If God tells us not to fear, why is he all of a sudden telling us, let us fear?
Because it's something to be afraid of.
Is falling short of heaven something to be afraid of? Chuck, did you say something?
Fear him who can destroy body and soul in hell.
Yes. Fear him who can kill both body and soul in hell, Jesus said of God in Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. Fear lest you fall short of heaven. When we get over to chapter 10, he says it is a fearful thing. Fearful. What? To fall into the hands of the living God. Do we need to fear falling short of heaven? Do we need to fear the idea that we could fall short in disobeying God? We need to make sure we're doing what God wants us to do. So he says in verse 2, "For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them." Talking about the good news of this rest was preached to us, and the good news of that rest was preached back to the Israelites. But the good news about the rest, he says it didn't do them any good. Why didn't it do them any good? The word which they heard did not profit them. Why not? Because it was not mixed with faith in those who heard it. Faith comes from hearing. So you've got to have that message. You've got to have the good news. You've got to have the rest, that promise of rest preached, the good news preaching. You got to hear it. But what comes, what is God's desired response from the hearing? Faith. What was wrong with the Israelites? What was the last word of chapter 3? Why did they not enter in? Because of unbelief. Here's a question. Did the Israelites believe in God? Yeah. Did they believe God had power? Yes. Did they believe that they had seen demonstrations of God's power? Yes. Why didn't they get to go to the promised land? Because they didn't believe. What? Wait a minute. They did believe. No. Their unbelief was seen in their disobedience. Go and take the land. What did they do? They didn't take the land. What did God say? You don't believe in me. You don't have faith in me. What they heard did them no good because it was not mixed with faith. Interesting how God takes preaching, hearing, believing, and obeying and puts it all together. You've got to do that. You've got to obey what God says. Verse 3, "For we who have believed," put that in the context of the Bible, not just a mental assent, it is an obedient faith. "We who have believed do enter that rest. We have the promise that we will enter into heaven. As he has said, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest." That was the quotation again. He's quoting it all over again from Psalm 95. But that was what God said in Numbers 14 when those unfaithful spies led the people into disobedience. God said, they shall not enter my rest. Now, as we go through this, when you read about heaven being a place of rest, that ought to give us all sorts of encouragement. That ought to be a huge motivator, that heaven is a promised rest. And so this should be one of the most comforting passages, although it was written to urge them not to turn their back on it. But the promise down in verse 9 where it says, "There remains therefore a rest for the people of God," that ought to give us great encouragement and comfort. But what has happened with chapter 4, as is what happens with a lot of fun, encouraging passages, is that individuals have gotten a hold of chapter 4 and twisted and turned this chapter to say things it never said. There are those who believe that we should still be keeping the Sabbath day, who have come to Hebrews chapter 4 and have manipulated this passage that talks about rest that was promised to the Jews, and they've manipulated it to try to say that the Sabbath is something that we must continue to keep today, that even Christians must continue to keep that Sabbath. There are others who have come to this passage and twisted it in such a way that they want this passage to say that at the end of time, when Jesus comes back, he is ultimately going to bring all of his people to the promised land so that they can possess the promised land, because they believe and teach that the Israelites never possessed the promised land as God had promised it to them. And so they think this is talking about not rest being in heaven, but rest being a final fulfillment of the promise of God that we will all go and live in Palestine. So maybe you've never heard of those two doctrines. Maybe you didn't know that they were people try to use Hebrews 4 to defend them. But I am going to make some comments relevant to those doctrines as we go through this, because those are serious doctrines that teach something the Bible doesn't teach. And so what often happens is that somebody comes to a text and they create a proof text, meaning they think they have found their little sugar stick in a statement that's made in a particular verse, and all of a sudden, oh, we still need to keep the Sabbath because of what this says. Oh, or no, we are going to finally get the promised land rest. You know what? Do you really want to go and live in Palestine when Jesus comes back? I mean, is that encouraging to you? Is that exciting to you? Is that what you're looking forward to? Good night. If that's what we're supposed to be looking forward to as a Christian, how pitiful is that? This isn't talking about that rest. It's talking about the promise that he has for us in heaven. So come to verse 3. We who have believed do enter that rest. It is a promise to us. As he has said, so I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. What works were finished? What does that mean? They shall not enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. There are those who come to this chapter and they want to teach that we still need to observe the Sabbath day today. And that is the ultimate rest that he is promising. But did he say that these Jews would not enter into his rest? How many times has he said that? They shall not enter my rest. If that's talking about the Sabbath day rest, did these Jews in Numbers 13 and 14 and the 40 years in the wilderness, did these Jews ever observe the Sabbath day? Did they ever keep the Sabbath day? They did. They kept the Sabbath day. It was one of the Ten Commandments. They kept the Sabbath day even while they were in the wilderness. They kept the Sabbath day. So if God's saying they shall not enter my rest, is he talking about the Sabbath day? Is it the Sabbath rest? No way. Because they did. They did take that rest. They did observe that rest. The works that were finished from the foundation of the world in verse 4 is an indication that God promised them his rest in his abode, and that was ready for them from the beginning. It was ready for them from the beginning. Verse 4. For he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way. Here's Genesis chapter 2. God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this place, he says, they shall not enter my rest. What's he talking about? What rest did God enter? Did God enter the Sabbath day, keep it holy rest? No. Did God enter the promised land of Canaan, Palestine rest? Is that the rest he entered? No. God entered the rest that is his. Notice he says it's mine. That is his in heaven. But what did God tell them that they would not enter? Here's a question for you. What rest did God say they shall not enter? Did he say they would not enter into the promised land? They would not enter into Canaan. Is that true? They would not enter into Canaan? Yes. But did some of them enter it? Did some of them enter the promised land? Yeah, of course they did. You got Joshua and Caleb and all of those who were under age, those who were under 20. They did enter the promised land. So he says, they shall not enter my rest, but some of them did enter. What rest is God talking about? He's talking about heaven. He promised heaven, not just, and there's kind of an idea here of the fulfillment in the Palestine Canaan promised land, but also of heaven, where he says God rested in heaven on that seventh day. But he said, you are not going to enter that rest with me in heaven. Verse 6, since therefore it remains, we saw that word in verse 1, since therefore it remains that some must enter it. How many are going to enter heaven? Some. Since therefore it remains that some enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter it. Why did they not enter it? Disobedience. Unbelief. They did not enter in because they did not obey God. What land did they not enter? Well, they did not enter the promised land. Could it be that God was saying, you're not going to enter into heaven either? They disobeyed God. Do they get a pass for disobeying God? So he says, to those who first preached, they didn't enter because of disobedience. Again, he designates a certain day, saying in, and this is an interesting way to say this, saying in what? What's the word, what's the name that you have there? Again, he designates a certain day, saying in David. Is there a book of the Old Testament called David? Genesis, actually. Nope, not a book of the Old Testament named David. Why would he say it's said in David? Where is this? Look at the word there. Today, this is a quotation from Psalm 95. He doesn't say it's said in Psalms. He says it is said in David. God wanted us to know who wrote Psalm 95. He wanted us to know when it was written. It is said, he designates a certain day saying in David, today. After such a long time. What does that mean? God said in Psalm 95 by the pen of David, today, after such a long time, as he said, do not harden your hearts. He's talking about the long time that transpired from Joshua to David. Were there a lot of years that transpired between Joshua and David? 450 years between the two. And that's what he's saying. After such a long time was this statement made. He said through David, today do not harden your hearts. What does that mean? It means that this promised rest was still available to the Jews, to the people in David's time. And it means they had not entered that rest yet. Look in verse 8. And this would be confusing because you might have the word Jesus in verse 8. Anybody got the word Jesus in verse 8? The word Jesus and the word Joshua are the same word. Joshua, if you were to write Jesus in Hebrew, you would be writing Joshua. If you were to write Joshua in Greek, you would be writing Jesus. That's the translation. But what he says is, if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. And this is the verse that some people like to hang some of their doctrines on. But what is he saying in that verse? If Joshua had given them rest. It's interesting he pulls Joshua's name out. Chapter 3 was about Moses. Did Moses lead them into the promised land? Did they enter the rest with Moses? No, they failed. But what did Joshua do? Joshua led them in. But he says, if Joshua had given them rest, as if to say, Joshua did not lead them into this rest. Well, what rest then? This cannot be talking about an occupation of Canaan. Because they were already occupied. We don't have time. Well, go over to the closing verses of Joshua 21. This is a verse that you need to know is in the Bible because the premillennial doctrine that teaches this idea that we're all going to be restored, that the Jews specifically are going to be restored when Jesus comes back. He's finally going to fulfill the promise he made to Abraham and give him the land. But look at the closing verses of Joshua chapter 21. Look at verse 43, Joshua 21:43. So the Lord gave to Israel. What word do you have after that? What's next? Anybody got the word all in your Bible? So the Lord gave to Israel all the land which he swore to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelt in it. When God made a promise to give the Israelites the land of Canaan, how much of it did he give to them? All of it. Look in 45. Not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. How much of it came to pass? All of it. So if you get into a discussion with somebody that wants to pull from this text in Hebrews 4 or from some other text, say, look, the Jews are going to be restored to Canaan when Jesus comes back because they never fully possessed that land that God promised to them. That's hogwash. That's not what the Bible teaches. And Joshua 21 says it. How much of the land did God give them? He gave it all to them. So what he's talking about in verse 8 is Joshua did not lead them into the rest of heaven. Therefore, David was talking about the rest of heaven. And that's why he says in verse 9, there remains therefore a rest. Interesting word that's used there. For the people of God. Only those who are God's children are going to enter that rest. For he who has entered his rest has himself also ceased from his works as God did from his. Has God completely ceased all activity, all work? No, he's still working. When we enter into the rest of heaven, does that mean we're going to stop doing everything? We're not going to do anything else? We will continue to serve. We will continue to serve him and as Revelation 22 teaches. Look in verse 11 and let me skim through these real quick. Let us... There's that exhortation again. Let us therefore be diligent. Word there means to strive, to exert yourself, be diligent to enter that rest. For those who want this to be the Sabbath rest, the Sabbath rest was not something that people would enter. Remember the Sabbath day to enter into it? Is that what it said? No, you keep it. It was a day. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. This is not that rest because he's talking about entering into a rest. Therefore, be diligent to enter that rest. And he gives a number of motivations for entering that rest. Lest, there's that word of warning again, anyone, this could happen to anybody, fall according to the same example of disobedience. We need to learn from the disobedience of the Jews and not fall short. We need to spend time with God's Word because God's Word is living. Same word for living God over in chapter 3. The Word of God is living. It's powerful. It's sharper than any two-edged sword. It penetrates, piercing even the division of soul and spirit, joints and marrow. And God's Word is a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. It looks inside of us. It will help us to make decisions. Why do I need to... What can motivate me to enter God's rest? Remember, there is no creature hidden from God's sight. Remember that God's abiding presence is with me everywhere. And remember, the end of verse 13, that all things are naked and exposed, open, laid bare to the eyes of him to whom we must give an account. He is strongly urging these Christians, don't turn your back on Christ. Because if you do, you are going to pay a penalty for it. If you do, there is an account that you are going to give on the day of judgment. And so he urges them to stay faithful. He urges them to enter, take the steps necessary to enter God's rest that he has promised to us in heaven that still remains for us. A lot there. Wish we could have digested a little bit more there. But thank you very much for your good attention during the study tonight.